Hi, I'm Bella Gandhi, founder of Smart Dating Academy and your host of this beautiful podcast. We're here to bring more love into your life, regardless of if you're single, if you're married, if you're thinking about becoming single, if you're thinking about becoming married or finding the lid to your pot. And we're going to bring more life into that love that you have or you want. You might have seen me on Good Morning America or Steve Harvey or the Today Show or 100 other places, but I'm so happy that you are here with us because we're going to make your life and your love better. Smart daters, welcome back. I am so excited to talk to you today, and we're going to hop right into a segment that I think you're going to want to listen to again and again and again. I'm bringing you back again, my friend, Dr. Lauren Stryker. If you haven't heard the episode we did last time, it was about dating and weight gain, an amazing episode. So Lauren, thank you for being here with us.
Well, you're welcome. I thought when you were going to say, this is an episode you're going to want to hear, I thought you were going to say, when you're alone, not when you're in a crowd of people, because we're going to get down deep and dirty and intimate.
Yeah.
You want to do this when you're with your mother, for example, I'm just saying.
Exactly. Get the little ones out of the room. Put your AirPods on, people. Get your headphones on, because today we're going to talk about sex and, most importantly, safe sex and fun sex. Okay. And they can all go hand in hand. But Lauren is here to tell us all of the things you guys know. She's a gynecologist. She runs a sexual health clinic at Northwestern University. And she's basically a celebrity in this world. So Lauren, let's get right into this. Tell us everything. Let's talk about sex and safe sex.
Well, the way I like to think of it is how to have a positive experience without testing positive. Because as you said, it's supposed to be fun. You don't want to spend so much time worrying about if you're going to get herpes or gonorrhea or chlamydia that you don't have a good time. But having said that, you can have fun and still keep it safe. But this is all about planning in advance, because in the moment is not the time to say, whoops, you know, I hadn't really thought about that. How am I going to protect myself against a sexually transmitted infection? But the numbers are going up in all age groups. And we see the highest numbers of sexually transmitted infections in the 20 to 30-year-old crowd. Why? Because, quite frankly, they're having the most sex. And it's not always safe sex. It's not always protected sex. But having said that, no age group is spared. Bacteria do not ask to see proof of age before they infect you. And we see infections, whether you're 30, 40, 50, 60, 70, 80, 90. And we see them more in women than in men, because women are more prone to getting a sexually transmitted infection than guys are. So unfair, but so true.
Why? Why is that the case?
A lot of it is because women have, you know, thinner skin. There's more of a chance that there's going to be a nice little portal of entry in the vaginal walls, because it doesn't take much. It can be a teeny little scratch or an abrasion, such that when there's a little bug or a virus in there, it's going to have access to crawling right into the tissue. And because women are the receivers instead of the givers, it is more likely. So I'm not saying that guys don't get STIs. Of course they do. Otherwise, who'd be giving it to the women? You know, so the guys.
Exactly.
It's just, it's more likely that if a woman has STI with a man, it's less likely that he's going to get something from her than if a woman has sex with a guy who has an infection. So, but everybody has to be careful, bottom line.
Right. And I know you and I have had many conversations about this, both online and offline, with drinks in our hand, talking about sex and when to have sex. And you smart daters, I know, subscribe to the Smart Dating Academy philosophy of sexclusivity, waiting to have sex until you're in a committed, exclusive relationship.
I agree with that. It's just the timing. That might be 10 minutes after you meet someone that you decide you're it. You're the lid for my pot. And we're blessed to be exclusive. And everyone says, yay. And then, yeah, I know that's an exaggeration. Not 10 minutes after.
Well, we want to keep all the narcissists and the avoidance at bay. And the only way to know that is over an extended amount of time, so that we can really kick the tires on seeing who this person is. You can build that connection and then ultimately have a partner, a boyfriend, a girlfriend, whatever you're going to call it, and then hit the hay, jump in the sack, do the nasty, and all of that. Now, here's what's particularly fascinating. We say sexclusivity. Now, what I also tell my clients is, oh, but I'm not saying we're in a convent. Okay. I'm saying there's a lap between zero and the big nasty. And Lauren is always educating me and out there educating all of us on the fact that just because you're not actually having sex, that doesn't necessarily mean you're not going to catch anything. So even if you're subscribing, you're like, okay, well, we're making out, we might be going to second base or third base.
Let's wait, you sound like you're in seventh grade. What's with the
I am in seventh grade. Do kids even
I'm going to put things a little more out there. Penile vaginal intercourse is not the only way to have sex. A lot of people think of that as actual sex, but the truth of the matter is that sexual activity can be oral, it can be anal, it can be digital with fingers, it can be with toys, it can be what we call outer course, meaning you get all naked and you're rubbing your genitals together, but there's not actual insertion. Those are all forms of sex, all of them. And those are all ways in which a sexually transmitted infection can be transmitted. But part of what people kind of fall into to feel like they're a little safer or they're not going to get themselves into trouble is they'll say, as Bella would say, well, we're really not going all the way. We're really not having sex. We're just fooling around. And I maintain that fooling around is sex. It's just a different kind of sex. It's a sex that maybe you're not going to get pregnant, but you are certainly having sex and you can certainly have an STI.
Okay. So maybe we can call this like BDAD, before the deed, after the deed, penile, vaginal, anal, where one thing's going into another. Okay. So does that sound fair? Like, what do we need to worry
about? Let's just divide it up to make it really simple. So we're all talking the same language.
Yes.
We can either have sexual activity with intercourse or sexual activity without intercourse.
Okay.
It's all sexual activity. But it's, are you having intercourse versus are you not having intercourse? Okay. Does that work for you?
That's perfect. So let's say we're in the beginnings. We're on like, you know, we're sort of just testing the waters out. We've got our dating funnel going. We're hanging out with multiple people. Now, what do we need to be thinking about?
Well, that depends on how naked you are. And
oh, I love where this is going. Turn the volume up, ladies and gentlemen.
I'm old enough that I used to read good old Ann Landers, who's now been dead for, I don't know, many years. And Ann Landers used to always say, as long as both of you have both feet on the ground, you have nothing to worry about. I don't know that I 100% agree with that because people can be very creative nowadays. But, you know, the idea of when you say, when are you going to get into trouble? I mean, the truth is you get into trouble in general when at least one person has their pants off. And I mean, their underpants too. You know, that's when things can go to the point of actually having a sexually transmitted infection. So I think at the point when you are getting down to that level is when you have to start thinking about, am I putting myself in a position where I might get something? And one of the big misconceptions about acquiring a sexually transmitted infection is this idea that it's only going to happen through intercourse. And the problem is that a lot of sexually transmitted bugs, they live on the skin. They're not in the vagina necessarily. They're not in the semen. They are on the skin. And I think when you think about it, you all know that. I mean, we know that you can have herpes on the outside and that you don't have to ejaculate for you to get herpes. You know, you can get herpes from your mouth, obviously. So, you know, that has nothing to do with actually having intercourse. We know that genital warts, HPV, which is the most common sexually transmitted infection, that lives on the skin and on, you know, what we call the mucous membranes, like the opening to the vagina, and also, you know, other places on the body that have mucous membranes. So there's a lot of there's a lot of potential for transmission of an STI, even if just one person has their clothes off.
Interesting. And so people will often ask me, like, Bella, do you think I should get tested? You know, should my partner get tested? What? And so my question to you is, when we say tested, and I put that in quotes, what does that even mean? And how, like, what should we do with us and our partners to make sure that we're both safe?
Right. Well, you know, that's probably one of the most common questions that we get in the clinic is people come in and say, I want to get tested for everything. And when we tell them there is no such thing as getting tested for everything, people are surprised to hear that because there's this kind of basic, you know, sense of, well, of course you can get tested. And then if you both get tested and you're both negative, then you're home free. And the truth of the matter is that there's no such thing as getting tested for everything. And to make it even more confusing, every doctor has their own little panel of what they might test for. So one woman might go to a clinic and say, I would like to get a test for sexually transmitted infection. And she might get a test for, say, gonorrhea and chlamydia. And then another clinic might also say, well, we're going to include syphilis. And then someone else may include hepatitis. So the idea of that you're going to go and get a test and be free and clear is simply not true. And this is even a bigger issue when you have asked that of your partner, and a willing, you know, lovely partner might say, sure, I'll go get tested. And then he or she come back and reports, I was tested and I was negative. And then there's this confidence level of, oh, good. You know, they were tested, so I don't need to worry about it. When in fact, the real question is, what were you tested for specifically? And so when someone comes to me and says, I would like a sexually transmitted infection screen, the first question I say to them is, are you having any symptoms? Now, most STIs are asymptomatic, but sometimes people do have symptoms that may lead me to test for a very specific infection. And then the second thing I'll say is, were you with a partner who you know to have a particular infection? Because if they come to me and say, yeah, I was with this guy and he told me after the fact that he has gonorrhea, well, then obviously I'm going to test you for gonorrhea. Actually, I'm just going to treat you for gonorrhea, but you know, but I'm going to test you for gonorrhea. And so once we have that conversation, then I will say to the woman, because my patients, of course, are all women, I'm a gynecologist, and I will say, okay, I am going to test you for the following, and then I list the following four or five things. There are many other things that I can test you for, and there are also things that we don't do as part of a standard battery. Is there anything else you had on your mind? Because I'm not a mind reader, you know, is there anything else that you were thinking about or worried about or concerned about that you would like me to test you for? And then we can have that discussion. But I mentioned HPV, human papillomavirus, is the most common sexually transmitted infection. And a lot of times people will say, oh, I want you to test me for HPV. Well, we actually can't really do that. And that's because, if someone has, let's say, a genital wart on their vulva or vagina, yes, I can test that for HPV. But if someone has a completely normal exam and I don't see anything and everything looks fine, I could certainly do a cervical swab to check for HPV, which is what's done during the Pap test, because we're checking for HPV as well, because HP, of course, increases your risk of not only cervical cancer, but vaginal cancer, vulvar cancer, penile cancer, et cetera. So we can do a swab. But what that swab tells us is not, do you have HPV? What it tells me is, do you have one of the high risk HPV that we are specifically testing for? And is it active right now? Meaning, it gets a little confusing, but this is important. So if somebody gets a Pap test, for example, and the Pap test comes back showing HPV, and they'll say, oh, did I just get it? Because my last Pap test was fine. And the answer is, we don't know. You could have had HPV for 10 years, but basically your HPV can go into hibernation. It can become inactive. So it's not always going to show up in a Pap test. So I don't know when you got it. But the other thing is there's 60 different subtypes of HPV. We don't test for all of them. We test for the ones that put you at increased risk of cancer. So if someone says, I don't have HPV because my pap test didn't show any, that's really not true. It means they didn't have a high risk HPV that was active at that moment. So to circle back to where this started, if someone comes in and says, I would like a test for HPV, what I say to them is, I can do a cervical swab and it will tell me if you have an active high risk HPV right now, but that's the only information I'm going to get. So the answer is no.
There's no blood test. There's nothing.
There's no blood test. I mean, you know, in research settings, certainly that's how they get, you know, all this epidemiological information. In research settings, certainly they can test for specific types of every type of HPV and all that. But from a practical point of view, I can't do that kind of testing in my office, and it's just not done. So, you know, again, people get this idea like, okay, I was tested, I'm negative. Same, like we talk about herpes. You know, herpes is, of course, extremely common. And if someone has a sore, I can certainly culture that sore to see if it's herpes. And if it's positive, it's herpes. If it's negative, it doesn't mean it's not herpes. It might be that it's just already drying up. You know, if you don't get it in the first 48, 72 hours, you're going to get a false negative. So that's not helpful. And if someone has no sore, well, I don't have anything to culture. And yes, we can do a blood test for herpes, but that blood test is going to be positive if you ever had a cold sore on your lip.
Ever.
So, yeah. Yeah. So, you know, again, we don't do herpes blood tests routinely for women who want an STI check, because we're going to get an awful lot of positives that may just be from a former cold sore. There's certain circumstances we do it, like pregnancy and all that, but in general, we are not doing routine testing for herpes. So in my clinic, if someone comes to me and they are asymptomatic and they just say, I would like a screen for sexually transmitted infection, what I do is my general basic screen is I do gonorrhea, chlamydia, syphilis, hepatitis, HIV. And then that's kind of my basic screen. And is that even a fraction of sexually transmitted infections? No. But those are the ones that we see most commonly and, you know, that we want to know about. But it's not like I'm saying if that's negative, you're not going to give them anything or her anything, because we also, you know that there are other things. The other thing also to keep in mind when you ask for that STI screen, unless you've only had vaginal exposure, don't forget about getting other places screened. You know, if you've had oral sex and you're concerned about having gotten oral gonorrhea, or, you know, you need to, you're looking horrified, Bella. They can't see this, but I'm telling you, look at your face. I wish everyone could see this. But we didn't even get to the anal issues yet, which was my next point. Is that we are seeing a huge increase in anal cancer. You know, it used to be that, I mean, not anal cancer, I'm sorry, anal intercourse. Edit that out. We are seeing a huge increase in anal sex. And it was always kind of the convention that if someone was having anal sex, of course it was a gay guy because they have anal sex. Well, that's simply not true. We know that in heterosexual couples, there's a lot of anal sex going on for a variety of reasons. Some is because people have just found it to be very pleasurable. The other is because they're avoiding pregnancy. And the other is because maybe they're not really thinking of it as having sex because it's not the Bella definition of sex. Just saying. But the point is if someone has had anal sex, well, then you need to tell your gynecologist that you would like a swab of your rectum as well, because you can be harboring gonorrhea, hepatitis, all of that can be in the rectum. So when you're thinking in terms of STI screening, it might be a little bit more comprehensive than maybe what you were thinking.
Interesting. So it's a swab. So you swab the vagina.
It depends on what you're testing for.
Okay.
So for gonorrhea and chlamydia, it's a cervical swab, like a pap test, basically. Uh-huh. Depending on which lab someone is using, sometimes they can do it all at the same time from the same swab. Those tests can also be done on the urine. And that's really important because a lot of people, for a variety of reasons, are not going to have a gynecologic exam, or they want to just go to their internist who may not be equipped to do that. And you can get a gonorrhea or a chlamydia test from a urine sample. It's not quite as accurate, but it's still, you know, definitely appropriate. Some things are blood tests. For example, syphilis is a blood test. Hepatitis is a blood test. HIV is a blood test. You know, rectal swabs, again, it depends what you're looking for. So it's really very much test specific. And it's funny how when I give people the menu and they'll pick and choose what they want, and I don't know what they're basing it on. Like a lot of times someone will say, well, while you're down there, you know, do a screen, and I'll say,
Do it all.
And I'll say, okay, well, I can do gonorrhea and chlamydia. And they'll go, yeah, do that. And then I'll say, okay, then we've got to draw your blood for, and then, you know, list all the stuff, and they'll go, no, that's okay, I'll just do the gonorrhea and chlamydia. And I'm like, okay, if, you know, those aren't the most common things, but if that's what you want, okay. So it's always interesting to me what people have on their menu of STIs.
That's interesting. So you typically would say an STI screen, if you're asymptomatic and you just is to test for these five things.
If you don't have a known exposure to something. Yeah.
Right. And just curious, if you're testing for five, everybody can test for different things. How many STIs exist? And maybe that's just a crazy question. Is it 50? Is it 500?
It's about 60.
Okay.
It's about 60, because if you define an STI as something that's transmitted sexually, even if we don't think of it as being sexual per se, that counts as an STI. So when you look at the list, it's really long. There's also sexually associated infections. So as an example, bacterial vaginosis is a very common form of vaginitis in women that causes vaginal discharge. It's the most common cause of vaginal discharge, abnormal vaginal discharge. And it's not a sexually transmitted infection. I want to be clear on that. Bacterial vaginosis is not sexually transmitted. However, it is associated with sexual activity, both women having sex with women and women having sex with men. And it really has to do with the change in the microbiome, in the environment from exposure to a new partner. So that's one of the things we see that a lot with people that have oral sex with new partners, sharing sex toys. We see this a lot, you know, with two women. So, you know, so there's both sexually associated and sexually transmitted. Another sexually transmitted infection, which is quite common that women don't think about, is something called trichomoniasis, which causes a funky vaginal discharge. And of course, every time a woman gets a vaginal discharge, she thinks that she has a yeast infection. And because the yeast medications are available over the counter, people go off and they buy all these yeast medications, and then the infection doesn't get better. And it's not because the medication wasn't good. It's because they were treating the wrong thing. Because it might be a bacterial vaginosis. It might be a trichomoniasis, which is a sexually transmitted infection. So, you know, there's a whole laundry list of things that people don't know about that may cause problems. But I want to circle back a little bit to symptoms, because we didn't really talk about what's a symptom? What could mean
great,
that someone
great,
has a sexually
great.
Transmitted infection? And one of the things that a lot of times people aren't thinking about is spotting. Because if someone has an infection that has caused an inflammation of the cervix or of the vaginal walls, they're going to spot. And of course, people automatically think, well, maybe it's, you know, breakthrough bleeding from my birth control, or maybe I have an IUD and there I go with spotting again. And in fact, if someone has had a new partner and they're spotting, that's a red flag to get in and get a screen for a sexually transmitted infection, because it may well be that is specifically because of an infection. We also, when we talk about discharges, and there's so many different causes of discharges, and certainly, you know, yeast is not the most common, bacterial vaginosis is, but a lot of these infections will cause a discharge. There's something that we describe as a mucopurulent discharge, which I know sounds really inviting. And this is just kind of a mucousy, pussy looking discharge that sometimes has some spotting in it. It may or may not have a little bit of an odor, but again, it's a red flag. Get in and get tested. And a lot of times a woman will come to me, and because some people are feeling shamed about having sex or having unprotected sex from listening to people who tell them not to have sex for a long time, that they don't want to admit that they've had sex.
Dun, dun, dun.
Dun, dun, dun. I'm shaming you now, Bella. But what happens is they won't tell me that's what they want. They'll just come in and they'll say, so how's everything look down there?
down there.
And I'm like, everything looks fine. Why? Just wondering how everything looks down there. And because I think they think that I'm going to, you know, number one, be clairvoyant and know that they need an STI screen. And number two, that that's what they're worried about. And then if I don't see anything and if there are no symptoms, it doesn't mean you don't need a screen because, again, most of these infections are asymptomatic. So and a lot of times people, you know, that they feel like they have to give me some kind of explanation. You know, like make well, you know, and he was a really nice guy and blah, blah, blah. All you need to say is, hi there, I'd like an STI screen, please. I am not going to ask you any questions beyond, do you have any symptoms or is there a particular thing that you're worried that you were exposed to that you'd like me to test for? You know, I don't care if you had sex with the whole football team. That's your problem, Bella. It's not my problem. I just want to know.
Oh, man.
Well, I want to know if it was consensual. I mean, that's a whole different story, and we can talk about that later. But I'm talking about if someone is having consensual sex with whoever, I make no judgment. I really don't. I just want to make sure that I am screening you to keep you safe, to make sure that if you have something that I can, you know, get you the proper treatment as quickly as possible.
Okay, I got that. That's great. That's awesome. So I think that gives us a tremendous education on the fact that, I mean, just, you know, be careful out there and get yourself tested, get your partner tested for these STI screens. And now Lauren has told you the minimum of what should be involved if you're asymptomatic, and just get on the same page with your partner or partners. Again, no judgment here. We're talking to everybody, and go from there. I think, you know, we got a lot of questions. I posted a sticker on Instagram for you guys to ask some questions. And I think that let's get to some of these. And there's a lot of questions here about orgasms from women. Do they get harder to come by as we age? Should I use toys? Do women have trouble reaching orgasm the older they get? So can you explain, give us the lowdown on the big O.
Yeah. That is my next book, by the way. I have a number of books, and I've started a series. Now, my books are directed towards postmenopause women, but quite frankly, any woman would benefit because the information
is amazing.
A lot of this stuff is for all age groups. But so my first book is Slip Sliding Way, Turning Back the Clock on Your Vagina. And that really is specifically for women who are no longer making estrogen and having difficulty with urinary symptoms and vaginal symptoms and all of that. My second book, Hot Flash Hell, is again, really directed at postmenopause because that's when they have hot flashes. But the third book that I'm working on is called Putting the O Back in Your Mojo. And it's a guide to orgasm. And the inability to have an orgasm is actually the second most common sexual complaint that is seen in sexual dysfunction clinics. So if you are having trouble out there, you are not alone. You are not the only one. And this is something that is absolutely fixable. Now, there's two categories of difficulty with orgasm. Category number one is someone who's never had an orgasm ever, 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 ever. And then category two is someone who has had orgasms just fine, and then something happens to make it go away. So when we talk about category one, which is quite common, women who've never had an orgasm, in those cases, sometimes there is a medical or biologic or hormonal problem, but in the overwhelming majority, these are women who need a map to their clitoris because they have the expectation, because no one has ever explained otherwise to them, that they are going to have an orgasm during intercourse. And then they don't, and they think that there's something wrong with them, as opposed to it is normal. It is normal to not have an orgasm during intercourse unless there is clitoral stimulation at the same time. And in fact, only about 20% of women orgasm during intercourse. So what we know is that when someone comes in the clinic and say she's, you know, 20, 30, 40 years old, and she comes in because she's never had an orgasm, and we always do an exam to make sure that she's neurologically intact, that everything anatomically is just fine and all that is good. And then if that's the case, then we actually sign that woman up to have some sessions with one of our amazing, wonderful sex therapists who really kind of do the deep dive into understanding what it takes to have an orgasm, in terms of maybe their cultural background, their religious background? Is there a history of abuse, of trauma? All of those things can impact on the ability to have an orgasm that are have nothing to do with someone's physical ability to have an orgasm. And this is, you know, so treatable, so treatable. Now, the second category are women that used to have orgasms just fine, and then something changed. And then when they're doing all the things that used to work before, suddenly it's not working. Well, what would cause that? There's a long list, but one of the things that we see, particularly in young women, is women who are put on antidepressants. You know, SSRIs are obviously very, very helpful and life-saving for a lot of people, but the SSRIs can cause sexual dysfunction. They can cause a decrease in libido, and in 30% of people, they can cause the loss of orgasm. So this sounds bad, but I'm going to give you the good news. The good news is, number one, for a lot of people, it's temporary. And for about 30% of that 30%, that lose their ability to orgasm, it gets better on its own with time.
Getting used to the SSRI.
Right. As the longer they've been on it, it gets better. So if someone comes to me and said, I was put on an SSRI 2 months ago and I can't orgasm, I tell them, if we do nothing, there's a 30% chance that it's going to come back. So let's just wait it out a little bit and see what happens. If it doesn't come back, then we have a number of options. Number one is sometimes decreasing the dose. This is not a do-it-yourself project. You know, you have to work with the person that prescribed it to see if maybe you can go down a little bit, because it does seem to be dose-related. Sometimes you can even be switched to a different antidepressant. We know that some of them are not likely to do this, like Wellbutrin is a popular one that does not have this sexual problem. But let's say you are in that category of person that says, nope, I need my SSRI to function. I can't go down on the dose. Nothing else works for me. I've been on it for a year and I can't have an orgasm. What do I do? Well, interestingly, this is one of the subsets of people that Viagra works in. And Viagra, of course, is used to treat erectile dysfunction in men. But in a number of studies, it has been shown to help women, specifically women who lose their orgasm because of an SSRI. And so we do prescribe it off-label. And again, this is not a do-it-yourself project. You know, the dosage is different. There are certain things you need to know. But it actually works pretty well in most women. When we look at women who aren't able to orgasm, that it's not an SSRI thing, that they've lost their ability to orgasm, there are a lot of reasons that that can happen. And just to make a sweeping generalization, in order to have an orgasm, you need a few things. One is you need to be aroused. If you're not aroused, you're not going to have an orgasm. That's why, you know, when we look at things like non-consensual sex, when someone gets raped or something like that, and these, you know, don't even get me started on people who think that that's in any way pleasurable, because I'm just going to, you know, rip my hair off.
I will too.
There's no way, if you are not aroused, that you are going to have an orgasm. If you are with a partner that you don't like, who is abusive, or who you haven't had proper stimulation, you're not going to have an orgasm unless you have a really vivid imagination and you pretend to someone else. I mean, seriously, that's what a lot of women do. They kind of disconnect and they kind of go into fantasy zone, and that makes it, they're married to someone who they don't like. People have all kinds of things they do to get around it. But the point I'm making is that you need to be aroused in order to have an orgasm. When you look at other requirements, and I do have a podcast on this, by the way, and, you know, it's all about orgasm. In terms of the requirements and how to have an orgasm. So I go into a lot more detail in that. And I do have this book coming out. But the other thing that needs to happen is it's all about sensation. You have to, the clitoris has 8,000 little nerve endings. And if those nerve endings don't fire, well, not much is going to happen. Well, what makes nerve endings healthy? Blood vessels do. So people that have vascular disease, diabetes, other vascular problems, even with aging, sometimes with different medications, those blood vessels are not going to be as healthy, which means the nerves aren't going to be as healthy. So what we do in the clinic, of course, when we find that that's the case, is we do things to increase blood flow. There's a lot of things we can do to increase clitoral blood flow. And then sometimes we increase sensation. So my point is that there are solutions. And one of the things I rail about is that when I talk to a big group of women, you and I are always out in the world talking to these big groups of women, and I'll say, okay, you know, there's 1,000 women in the audience. And I'll say, okay, when you went to the doctor last time, did they ask you about your sexual function, or are you sexually active? And every hand goes up, right? And then I'll say, okay, did your doctor ask if you were having any pain or problems with sex? Leave your hand up. And, 80% of the hands go down. And then I'll say, leave your hand up if your doctor asked if you were able to have an orgasm. There's never one single hand in the air. Unless you were coming to someone like me or to a sexual medicine clinic, the chances that your doctor is actually going to ask you about your ability to have an orgasm is slim to none.
Wow.
And you know, as I mentioned, when we see people who are really at high risk, who are diabetics, who have multiple sclerosis, or, other medical conditions which are going to inhibit that pathway to pleasure, no one's asking about it. So you assume they're not asking because there's no solutions. They're not asking about it because they don't know the solutions, but there are those of us that do. There are solutions. And if you get nothing else from this whole thing I just said, it's that if you are having difficulty with having an orgasm, we can help you. This is not something that you have to accept. This is one of those things that more often than not, we are able to help in that circumstance.
Isn't that great for those of you who think that is my problem? I'm taking a sip of water. Give me a minute.
I'll give you a minute. But the other thing also, while you're drinking water, I'll just keep talking because that's what I do.
Please do. You do that well for me.
Is that sometimes it's a clueless partner. We talk about a woman not having a map to her clitoris. Well, the guy needs a map as well. There's a book. I'm going to hold it up, even though this is a podcast, but it's called Becoming Clitorate. I don't know if you know.
I love that. With the C, not becoming literate.
Becoming Clitorate. Literate. It's written by Dr. Lori Mintz, who's amazing. And I am I have scheduled to do a podcast with Dr. Mintz, which probably will not be out there until November, December 22, but I'm very excited for that conversation. But her book is really hugely, hugely helpful for men and women to read in terms of really understanding female sexual function and what it takes for a woman to have pleasure. Because, it's not like your mother told you,
Right. Or it's not like his mother or her mother told her either.
No, in fact, we're in a society where it's all about male pleasure. And in fact, there was a book written by Lisa Ornstein, Girls and Sex, in which she interviewed hundreds and hundreds of young women and teenagers about their expectations about being sexual. And it was all about his pleasure. These were heterosexual girls, and it was never about, their pleasure. And then when you have sex ed, for those of us that get sex ed, it's all about not getting pregnant. It might be about STI prevention, but very rarely in sex ed does anybody talk about pleasure or specifically female pleasure. So you can't blame women for not knowing. And people are like, okay, but mothers should have this conversation with their daughters. And my response always is, yeah, but someone's got to educate the mothers first.
That's right.
It's not like the mothers know so much. Did your mother sit down and talk to you about?
No.
Yeah. She just tells you don't have sex until you've been exclusive for how long?
Until you have a ring on your finger.
Right. Yeah.
Speaking of orgasm, another question that came in from someone in our audience, it says he won't wear a condom due to his performance issues. What should I do about STDs? I'm a woman.
Yeah. Let's get rid of the myth that a condom is going to prevent STDs, STIs, because a male condom covers the penis. It does not cover the scrotum. It does not cover the perianal area. It does not cover the mouth. It does not cover the thighs. And these are all areas where herpes can live, HPV can live, etc. So let's get rid of the myth that if he wears a condom, you are protected. But having said that,
wow, just wow.
Yeah, oh my God. We'll go back to that. But let's talk about the guy who won't wear a condom. So we see this mainly. There's kind of two groups of guys that refuse to wear condoms. One are older men that truly do have difficulty maintaining an erection if they put a condom on. And one of my podcasts with one of my favorite urologists, Dr. Rachel Rubin, is called Need to Know Information About the Penis in Your Bed. And we talk quite a bit about that guy, the guy who cannot use a condom, who can't maintain an erection, and what the fixes are for that. In young guys, sometimes even young guys have problems maintaining an erection, not for the same reasons necessarily. They have a lot of problems with premature ejaculation, and the condom, can sometimes just get in the way of the whole thing. And then we have some guys who just, quite frankly, it's all about them. And then at least this guy is telling her he doesn't want to wear a condom so that she can protect herself. We've all heard of stealthing, which is the guy who puts the condom on, and then right when he's about to go inside, he slips it off, which is, not to her knowledge, which first of all is not only rape and sexual abuse, it is also illegal in some states. California,
I have chills.
That is illegal. So, that's really scary stuff. But for this woman, this is obviously decision time, because this is the guy that's going to say, even if she's using, we're not going to even talk about pregnancy, we'll assume that she's using her own birth control because women just have to take care of themselves, right? But, even if he says, I've been tested for everything, well, we've already established there's no such thing. And so if he's not willing to use a condom, it's really just decision time. Now, there is a female condom, and a lot of people are not aware of it. It's called the FC2 condom. And what this is you can get it over the counter, and it is a sheath that goes inside the woman's vagina, that there's a ring that goes on the outside that covers the vulva. And the beauty of the female condom is that it actually protects better than a male condom, because not only does it a sheath so that you don't get exposure to his penis, but it also means that your vulva is covered so that, you're not going to get that skin to skin. And if he is going to give her oral sex with the female condom on, and we'll talk about some other protection options as well, but there's also, there's that. The female condom has never really caught on. Most women have not heard about it. It has been around for at least 10 years. It's actually used more in other countries. One of the reasons that it hasn't caught on is first of all, it's a little, not very, but it's a little bit, you got to practice. It takes two or three tries until you can easily get it in. But women don't like using them because of the appearance. You basically have a ring hanging out of your vagina. It doesn't decrease sensation. It's made out of surgical glove material, so you can feel just fine. And the ring actually sometimes presses against the clitoris. So some people say there's even enhanced sensation, but it's really more about the appearance, and it's a little bit cumbersome to use. So, but that is, if he truly refuses to wear a condom, that would be her best bet in terms of having intercourse and avoiding an STI.
Is one more effective than the other in preventing STIs, male or female condom?
The female condom is better. It covers the vulva as well.
More. Mm-hmm. Okay, yeah. Got it. And tell us about...
And it won't roll off.
Oh, yeah.
Sometimes the male condom can roll off if he comes out and doesn't, hold the base of it, et cetera. So, and he can't take the female condom off, but you know what I'm just saying. You have the woman, every time the woman has control, things go much better.
Right. I mean, that's just life in general.
In life, right.
And of course, you were telling me, and I was listening to some of your podcasts to prep for this episode. Tell us about this newfangled, amazing thing, these panties that are protective and look cute. And just tell me about these things.
So these are latex panties for women to wear to protect while they are either giving or receiving oral sex. So this is not for penetrative sex because they're panties, but basically these panties are called Laurels, and they are FDA cleared for prevention of sexually transmitted infections, which is pretty recent.
Wow.
And so basically the woman wears these Laurels, and while she's wearing them, she can receive oral sex, which means that if she has an infection in her vagina or on her vulva, she won't give it to the person giving her oral sex. And if that person has something on his or her mouth, like herpes, they can't give it to her. So it is protective for oral sex. It is protective for anal play. And they're really catching on because people are looking for protection for oral sexual encounters because there really hasn't been anything, you know, and for a woman to use because you've heard of dental dams, but, you know, have you ever known anyone who's used a dental dam other than a dentist? And
no.
Not to mention, it's kind of cumbersome. It's a sheet of latex that you're supposed to spread over your vulva and hold there. Well, that sounds like fun. So this is really a workaround for that. And they're disposable, so it's a one-wear thing. But definitely, you know, if women want to have sex on their period, if they want to have oral sex while they have their period, if they are using some kind of medication, if maybe the guy has a scratchy beard. I mean, the list is actually pretty long of circumstances that women can have more pleasurable sex, oral sex, if they are using these panties. So that's kind of a cool new innovation.
That is cool. So let's say you want to start with oral, but then end with, you know, traditional intercourse. Yeah. You could just slide them over or take them off like it was a normal pair of underwear.
You got it.
Right. Good old fashioned style.
They're black.
Stand up around your ankles.
Yeah, they're black and they have an L on it in pink, which is very pretty. And so when I did my podcast on safe sex about this and I was talking about it, and of course, I decided that the L was for Lauren and that every, that you could get them with a B on it, for example. And I was interviewing the CEO of the company who told me sadly that no, the L was not for Lauren. It was for Laurels. But I like to believe that the L was for Lauren. So.
That's amazing. So, so awesome. I think, and, you know, talk, I love your general statistics that have come from your surveys. Tell us, I don't think we can ever hear too much about waxing, lasering, pubic hair. Tell us about this. And if women, so many women that I work with at Smart Dating Academy have come out of divorce, or maybe they've never had sex, or they haven't had sex with a new partner since 1983. What do they need to know about the land down there and what's appealing to men?
Well, first of all, the land down there is a very obviously private area. I will start by saying that there is a biologic function to pubic hair. There's a reason that people have pubic hair. And while in the hundreds of years ago, it was to keep the genitals warm before central heating. Now we don't in general need that unless your heating goes out or you're having sex outside. But the major benefit to pubic hair is it provides lubrication and it decreases friction. So you don't get those nasty rug burns. But having said that, for a number of years now, the style has been less is more. And you know, it's, I got to tell you about, you know, I'm a gynecologist, obviously, so I'm looking at women's vulvas all day long and I barely notice, other than to say that I really right now see it all. You know, a lot of people, it's completely bare. A lot of people have a little landing strip. A lot of people just trim. And some people do absolutely nothing and never have. And it's all normal. It's all good. It's all fine. You know, this is personal preference. But the survey that you're talking about is, you know, the question always is, do you do these things for yourself or do you do it for someone else? And does that person really care? And so I did a survey where I asked a lot of different questions, as you know, because we've talked about it before. But one of them was to men, what is your preferred pubic hairstyle? And it was multiple choice. And the options
for women.
Right. What is your preferred hairstyle for a woman? This was for male, female sex. What is the guy's preferred hairstyle for the woman he is having sex with? And the choices were, you know, completely bare, landing strip, trim, or full bush. And basically, oh, and then the last choice was, I don't care. I just want to be invited to the party. And that's what most guys said, is they really didn't care. Trimmed came in second, actually. So I think that, you know, for women who think that all these guys want your vulva to look like you're a 9-year-old girl, that is not the case. Some guys, I can't speak for all men, certainly some of them like that. Everyone has personal preference. But this idea that you have to remove all of your hair in order to be sexually attractive is simply not true. One of the things that I've noticed a lot is that it's the young women, if someone's going to be bare, It's the young women, and it's not necessarily women who are having sex. It's kind of the whole idea of if you shave your legs, if you shave under your arms, that you should shave your vulva as well. And it's, you know, that didn't used to be the case. And I keep thinking that it's going to turn around. You know, hairstyles change on your head. They change down south as well. But I'm still seeing plenty of women who remove it all.
Wow. And no issues. It's just personal cosmetic.
You know, I mean, the friction issues. There is one sexually transmitted infection that is more common. It was funny because a lot of women say they feel cleaner, that it's cleaner, but it's not cleaner. You know, if you, it's like saying
protecting
you have to
hair.
Well, it's like saying that if you have to shave your head in order to have a clean scalp, you know, if you wash your vulva with, you know, mild soap and water, or quite frankly, just water, you know, you don't need to remove your hair to be hygienic. But there's an infection called molluscum contagiosum. Have you ever heard of that one?
Yes.
Yes. Little bumps. And that's another example of a sexually transmitted infection that people don't always think about. It happens to be more common in women that remove their pubic hair. I don't know why. But anyway. So when you look at the downside is that there is more chance of rug burn, friction, and all that because you lose lubrication. But the real downside isn't having removed your pubic hair. It's how you remove it. Nicks, cuts, burns, we've seen it all. So some people get little red bumps no matter what they do. We see a lot of chemical burns from those hair, you know, those depilatories, those lotions.
Like Nair.
Yeah. Oh God, don't put that on your vulva. We see people that try and do, you know, do it yourself waxing and the wax is too hot and they burn. I mean, you can figure that out. I mean, there's just a lot of things that can happen and you just want to be careful.
Oh God. Oh, wow. 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 Well, so to wrap this up, give us,
you mean you don't want to hear any more about the disasters that can happen?
Oh my God. I was making a silly little joke in my mind to wrap it up. You know what I mean? Like wrap up, you know, when.
So usually
like,
that's when we talk about anal sex because we talk about the perfect ending.
Oh, okay. Let's talk about.
I guess we're not wrapping it up yet.
Before we
wrap it up,
let's talk about, you know, top or bottom. Just kidding.
Yeah. So this is the thing with anal sex, and there is a lot more of it. The vagina is meant to be a two-way passage. Penises are supposed to come in. Babies are supposed to come out. the anus is meant to be a one-way passage. It is. Nothing is supposed to be going up there. And it's not made for it, meaning that a vagina has nice, stretchy, accordion-like tissue to accommodate a penis. And the rectum doesn't. And in addition, the rectum has this little muscle, the sphincter. So what happens if someone has anal sex, men or women, is that we see sometimes that there's an increased risk of stool incontinence because of damage to that muscle. There's increased risk of infections because the tissue can get torn. We see problems as a result of anal sex. So this isn't a judgment thing. You know, I don't care, you know, where someone wants, what someone wants to do sexually. I'm just taking it from the point of view of medically, what are the risks? And there are risks. And in addition to the fact that people often don't get screened for anal STIs, for rectal STIs, and we're seeing an increase in anal cancers. These anal cancers are HPV cancers that are generally a result of sexual activity. So if you choose to have anal sex, there's a couple of things that you need to keep in mind. Number one is you do need to use protection. You do need to use a condom just as you would for vaginal sex. Number two is you do need to get screened for sexually transmitted infections with a separate swab. The swab that you have from the vagina is not going to be enough. Number three is it obviously needs to be consensual, but it's not that obvious because a lot of women do it and really are not all gung-ho because they have a partner who's insistent and who wants to do it and they go along with it even though it's not something that they find to be pleasurable. And I am just saying, please do not agree to do things that you don't want to do and that are not pleasurable for you. But if this is something that you want to do, you need to make sure that you take it very, very slow, that you use a lot of lubrication and listen to your body. If it hurts a lot, then you have to stop, because if it hurts, it means that there's a chance that something is getting damaged, that something is getting torn. And some of these things can cause long-term problems. So this is just a cautionary tale. I'm not, you know, far be it from me to tell you not to do it, but I think like everything else, you have to make an informed decision before you do something and then decide if the risk is worth it to you.
Exactly. And I love what you said. Listen to your body. Pain is usually a sign that something is wrong.
Right. And we didn't talk about painful sex today. And we won't get into that because that's a whole other topic, other than for me to say you should never have pain with sex. If you are having pain with sex, there is no, you know, bear it. There's no tough it out. There's no, I thought sex was supposed to hurt. Sex is never supposed to hurt. And we can fix that.
Okay. Well, ladies and gentlemen, if you heard that, and if you are having painful sex, which I hear a lot of people saying it burns, it's hard. Blah, 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 blah. Do you have a couple sentences you want to give us around painful sex?
Well, you know, the thing about painful sex is obviously I run a sexual medicine clinic. We see everyone has this idea that we are seeing older women, the women over the age of 50, generally in the menopause clinic, the women that we are seeing in our sexual medicine clinic are in their 20s, their 30s, their 40s. The majority of them are coming to us because they're having painful sex. The majority of them, we are not the first, second, third, or fourth opinion. We are the fifth, sixth, or seventh opinion. And my message out there is, number one, you should never have pain with sex. And number two, if you have not been given a solution from your doctor, it doesn't mean that there isn't a solution. It just means you need to see someone who's an expert in this. And obviously, I'm in Chicago, but there are sexual medicine experts in every big city. I wish I could say that they were in every small town. They are not. But sometimes you have to travel. And we have telehealth now. And I always say that telehealth doesn't really work very well for sexual pain, because it's one of those situations we really, really, really need to examine you. But sometimes we can get a lot just from taking a history. And, in fact, I have a wonderful podcast on pelvic floor PT, physical therapy, which is when the muscles clamp down when you have pain because of vaginismus, and talk about how even sometimes that can be done virtually. So we have solutions. This is not something you should ever put up with, and you are not alone.
Oh, I love that. What a great way to truly wrap it up, top to bottom. We covered it all.
Top to bottom, yes.
We covered it all, top to bottom. No puns intended. So,
well, Lauren, we didn't get to foot pain with orgasms. We'll talk about that next time. That would be tough.
Well, maybe we can also talk about foot fetishes at that time.
Oh God, we can do, yeah.
I did what have
thing about feet is that you and I both like shoes, and that has nothing to do with sex. We just like shoes.
Right. I did have a woman who went on a date with a guy years ago, and he looked at her feet and he's like, I just want you to know I have a foot fetish. And she's like, oh, ha, ha, ha. He's like, no, really. And she decided not to go on a second date with him. So just saying, right. Remember, people need to earn your story. And on that note, Lauren, thank you so much for being here. I know we'll have you back again and again, because you are amazing in every way. So thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening. And as always, download us, share us, show us the love. Follow Instagram at Smart Dating Academy. And if you or someone you know wants to learn more, check out our website at smartdatingacademy.com. We're here to bring you love.